I'm Tom Clark.
And I'm Allegra Strassen.
And this is Politics Weekly.
On today's show, we are looking at Ed Miliband's low-carbon plan. Can it really help green the country?
Cleaning up politics, we ask whether the Parliamentary Standards Bill is a case of quick cook and slow indigestion.
And also, as term comes to an end, we're giving the government its annual report card.
In the pod today, we have comment supremo Georgina Henry and chief leader writer Julian Glover.
But quickly, a little reading list. The Tories have put out their reading list. George, what are you going to be reading?
I never read politics on holiday, ever.
Okay, novel.
I'm struggling through. Well, not struggling, but it is so enormous that I can't quite hold it on the beach, I think.
Ulysses,
but anyway, no, 2666, this Roberta Bolaño kind of epic novel, which I'm one book into, and I'm kind of debating. I mean, the trouble is, it takes me over my kind of, you know, luggage level in one go. But nevertheless, I'd love to read it. And when else do you get time?
Julian?
One serious book and one thriller. The thriller will be Duncan Campbell's one about a newspaper, possibly not so far from this one, which reading yet. I'm sure it's excellent.
Duncan Campbell is a former Guardian journalist.
Yes.
And what's the serious one? Is that the serious one?
Vernon Bognor on the British Constitution.
Tom, bloody hell. Tom? Well, the thing I've got, I'm going on holiday next week, and the first thing I've got to read is a book on speech writing by one of my friends who wants detailed comments.
Oh, so that's kind of Tom. That's worse.
It's slightly worthy.
Beyond friendship.
And you?
A mixture of George, it's a novel, but I hope it's got some politics in it. It's the A.S. Byatt, the children's book. It's about a messed up Fabian family.
Oh, well, that sounds great.
Yeah, exactly. What a barrel of laughs that'll be.
This week, Ed Miliband announced his low-carbon transition plan.
All of us in this House know the gravity of the challenge that climate change poses. We know that to the rise to the challenge will mean comprehensive changes in our economy and our society.
And indeed, no aspect of life was spared, from home insulation to power generation, from electric cars to high-speed trains. The aim is to achieve emissions cuts of 34% by 2020, at least compared to 1990 levels. Julian, we'll get on to whether it makes any sense in a minute, but first of all, what would you pick out as the headline?
I think the core thing is to see this not just as a climate change policy, but an energy policy. And the key part of the document is really about how our electricity is going to be made in 10, 15, 20 years' time. Everything else is fascinating, but this is the core bit. The idea is we'll move from carbon-producing energy, from basically coal, bit of gas, bit of oil to back it up sometimes, to non-carbon-emitting energy, mainly nuclear power, a bit of wind, maybe some wave energy if they can make the technology work. But the core thing is just to shift away to how they make electricity. Everything else, it's really window dressing beyond that.
Well, that call sounds promising, maybe, but is there a catch? George Monbiot is always a hard man to please.
It seems on first reading that there's a lot of positive stuff in it. The devil's going to be in the detail. We need to work out exactly how much of this is new. We need to work out to what extent the renewables that the government's proposing are indeed going to fill the gap. I was very pleased and relieved to see that the government is not currently intending to use offsets to meet its carbon cuts. So it looks as if it's going in the right direction. Of course, overall, we're not going there nearly fast enough, and we need to be looking at much deeper cuts much sooner than those that the government is talking about. Ed Miliband already seems to have exempted aviation from this 80% cut, which begs the question, well, first of all, why? What's so special about aviation? Is it more special than heating and lighting and all the other things which we regard as essential to our lives? And secondly, which sector is going to bear the brunt of the cuts which aviation would otherwise have carried? And why is it that a Labour minister is so keen to feather bed an industry which is largely used by the upper middle and upper classes in this country?
George, what are other people saying on the site?
Well, actually, it's broadly positive. I mean, as George says, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in there. And, you know, as you said,
George, by the way.
Yeah, sorry, George Bombio said.
Not myself.
That there's a lot in here that actually does please pretty difficult people to please. I mean, George has been a resolute critic of much of the government strategy. So I think that's been very interesting to watch. A lot of people have made
Linus
this.
Mark Linus is pleased.
Mark Linus is generally more positive than George, actually. They point all the Greens writing point to this gap in government strategy that they see, the contradiction about aviation, which I think is really interesting, and the pursuit of extra runway, etc. over this idea, you know, and the sort of the quotes earlier this week about we don't want to stop people flying and that sort of thing. And they're putting a huge amount, and a lot of people are pointing this out, a huge amount of faith in the ability to kind of bring down the carbon level emissions levels of those planes and other forms of transport. So a lot of people make that point. I think there's been quite a bit of a discussion about the cost of this, and there's some sense that are the government figures in the white paper released yesterday quite accurately reflecting, because, you know, that relies a lot on whether or not you're actually able to save energy too, as well as the cost of energy. But I think there's a general feeling that finally, at last, albeit less than a year from an election, the government is very much moving in the right direction. So actually he gets the thumbs up from a lot of people.
And he seemed, from comments in the chamber yesterday from the very genteel Greg Clark, who's the Tories' environment, shadow environment minister, that they also gave him at least one thumb up.
Yeah, so it's an interesting debate we've got in Britain, and we ought to be quite pleased about it. If you look at other countries, Australia, for instance, the opposition there challenging the government on climate change, not because they're not doing enough, but because they believe it exists, more or less. Mm. In Britain, the debate is much more mature than that. Of course, if you don't believe climate change exists, you'd regard it as much more exclusive. The Conservative Party says, as all oppositions do, as Labour did in opposition too, you didn't do this early enough, you know enough so far. Mm. They're talking about the past. Ed Miliband looked a bit miffed at that yesterday. He seemed slightly wounded, but it's true, and the government accepts it's true. Going forward, well, the Conservative Party opposes a third runway at Heathrow, largely because there's a lot of voters in West London, and also because it just annoys the Labour Party. Whether they'll build it, we'll see. Mm. Otherwise, not a lot of policy disagreement. The great challenge, though, is paying for it. There's very few numbers in this document. The white paper comes surrounded with hundreds of other documents as well, and the white paper's 150 pages.
What are the big spending commitments?
Well, the big spending commitments are all hidden, because the idea is that power bills will pay for everything. And quite possibly they could, particularly if the oil price rises back up to $100, $150. It's based on the idea that oil's $80 a barrel. At the moment, it's a bit below that. If oil is at $80 a barrel in 2020, which is unlikely, I think, power bills will go up a bit. If we get enough insulation in homes, the idea is they'll go up £400 or £500 a year, in real terms, per person, because their homes will use less energy. The actual amount of it they pay for their energy will be substantially higher, and that will fund all of these great new things. Mm. The chances of all this happening by 2020, though, are pretty much zero. I think the speed, 10 years to build nuclear power stations, invent a whole generation of wave technology, get carbon capture, not yet fully up and running, but really in existence and close to running, it's not going to happen. If you look at some of the detailed plans, even high-speed rail, that isn't going to go to 2025. Building these things will take much longer.
Do you think, though, this lovely consensus that we might be working towards, as soon as the bills do start to come in, whether it's higher fuel prices at the pump or whether it's higher home energy bills or whatever, do you think that consensus will start to fracture then?
I do, because you know, because I'm not sure the government's put enough money into helping people do things to save on their energy bills. The sums, as far as I can work out, seem quite small in that respect, and there are an awful lot of houses that could do with much better insulation. I mean, that is something that comes up again and again, because I think it will really affect people when the true cost of this. I mean, it's not a reason for not doing it, but you know, since the blogosphere. I mean, talking about the people now putting comments on these articles is full of climate change deniers. Quite how they're orchestrated is a matter of opinion. But, you know, there are plenty of people saying that this is not just unnecessary, but it's another way that the government's kind of ratcheting up the bills. We're all going to have to pay for this. So there is a lot of disquiet around there, and it'll grow, I assume.
And that's why the government has to explain it's an energy policy. And energy policy is, in their nature, an incredibly boring thing. Energy isn't something the public want to know about.
Yeah.
They want power to come out of the socket on the wall. They just want the government and businesses to sort out what kind of system makes that power. And we're going to have to invest a large amount of money in replacing our energy producing stock anyway, whether we build new gas stations or whatever. We're also going to have to upgrade the national grid. So much of this is going to happen regardless of climate change. So I'm a bit more optimistic than you are.
Yeah, why do you think there's this obsession about kind of ring-fencing aviation? I just don't get this bit of it.
Well, partly because aviation is almost entirely an international thing. Government would argue if you crack down on the British aviation industry, it'll all move to Frankfurt. Well, maybe we'll go and change planes there. The other thing, of course, is that aviation is something the middle classes use, and they vote quite a lot, and they're members of political parties, and people in this building at The Guardian all fly too. Well, so we're all pretty hypocritical.
I would have thought the Miliband's argument is more that it is something that the dare I say it, lower classes also use.
Well, he tries to make that argument.
But you think that's bogus?
Well, the figures are not really there, are they?
But it's interesting for another reason, which is actually one of the refreshing things about this yesterday. I mean, maybe we're being a bit rosy and, you know, it'll all come to grief, but is that it does seem quite a brave bit of politics, which, you know, we haven't been used to seeing for a while. And yet there is this reluctance to really engage with the arguments about flying. And that puzzles me.
OK, well, we will leave it there for the moment. For all things green, visit guardian.co.uk/environment. Panicked times, of course, always get panicked measures. And no time has been more panicked in Westminster than after the expenses scandal. The rushed parliamentary standards bill was meant to sort it all out, but it is now running into difficulties. Julian is going to talk us through the sticking points.
Well, this bill emerged out of Gordon Brown's announcement he was going to do something about expenses. There was going to be a tough new law and a tough regulator, and MPs are going to be thrown in prison possibly forever if they claim more than 3 crisp packets a year. And it all sounded terribly good. And, of course, the opposition had to say, well, we back this law too, because if they hadn't, they would have looked like the corrupt MP's friend. So, in principle, they backed it. Suddenly, this bill arrived. First of all, it arrived in a sort of private chat between the parties, and various people threw their arms up in horror and said, but you haven't thought this through, it's terrible. And bits of it were deleted. It was then published. More people threw their arms up in horror and said, but you haven't thought it through. To the government's credit, or at least to Jack Straw's credit, who's been leading on this process, Harriet Harman somehow made the written statement announcing the bill but hasn't been heard from much since on it.
I got in so much trouble when I reported it and I said it was Harriet Harman's.
Yes, I mean, Harriet had to sort of announce it, but nothing more. It's Jack Straw's bill. He's been very wise. I think he probably thinks the whole thing's pretty rubbish, but he has to do it because the government said it will. The great difficulty is that they said they'd get it in law by the time Parliament rose at the start of next week for the summer so that we could lock up MPs from the autumn. And doing that has been really difficult. The whole principle of legislation from the government recently has been to give time, to have draft legislation, to have committees, to have all sorts of proper debate. And this is a fundamental change to a constitutional principle that's being rushed through in about 3 weeks.
Can you tell us what things they've cut out, Julian?
Well, one of the first things was to introduce the idea that the proceedings of Parliament could be used in court cases. So if an MP said in Parliament, you know, something nice about British Airways, and it turned out later that they were given free flights by British Airways, that could be used to prosecute them. There's a whole tradition of parliamentary comments being privileged, it's said, that you can't use that against somebody outside the chamber. It can be reported. So people are free to say things. And people like David Davis used it recently with The Guardian to talk about torture. He could say things that outside he might have found hard to say. So MPs were very worried about it, quite rightly. The government finally dropped that. Another aspect was the idea of having specific laws that could only be used against MPs. Generally in law, if you commit an offence, it applies to all citizens. If you murder somebody, that's illegal, whatever your status. Having specific laws for specific categories of people is something that lawyers are very unhappy about, and that's been very controversial. So the bill has got thinner and thinner. It went through the House of Commons in 3 days. They actually guillotined the vote. They didn't even have a debate on the abolition of parliamentary privilege in the Commons. It then went to the Lords. Wise Lords sat and pontificated as they like to do. Senior judges were very senior. They stirred themselves to produce 3 reports from different committees in 3 days. And actually, it's been quite a good process for Parliament. It's all speeded up. But they have more or less stripped out the bad bits.
But George, you have quite a simple answer to all this, don't you? They should just not go on holiday.
Well, I think, I mean, the thing is, the new, you know, we've been debating new politics in The Guardian for the last couple of months, and the standards bill is one part of that. But there's a sort of broader agenda that seems to be going nowhere fast. And yes, to pick up your point, you know, the idea they're about to disappear on holiday till October, I think is extremely irritating for quite a lot of people. So a lot of the things we've been debating in The Guardian, which are at its most simple, you know, perhaps shorter holidays or fixed term, you know, and then there's big questions about fixed term parliaments, the elected Lords, party funding. Actually, some of, you know, there have been moves on these things alongside the ever weaker parliamentary standards bill. But what you don't get is the feeling as they go on holiday for 3 months. Is it 3 months? Yes. That, you know, suddenly they've, that actually the public is looking at a reformed and substantially changed or about to, House of Commons or Parliament in general. general. And I think that is a problem. I mean, they would say, well, you know, these things take time. And that's obviously true. But I think there is still a lack of urgency about it all. I mean, all the ideas we've been floating around, I mean, clearly nothing's going to happen on electoral reform. The government's not interested. The opposition isn't interested. The fact that lots of people around are talking about it again and so on is neither here nor there. There has been a little bit of effort on the Lords. But I also think if you talk to any government minister privately, they say it's not going to happen because there's going to be an election. There's an interesting thing, wasn't there, Julian, last week on party funding?
Yeah, there was a move on overseas donations to parties, which
but most people think it's a party political thing to get at Lord Ashcroft. So,
and which will fail, actually.
So there isn't a sense that they've really understood the crisis that befell, I think most people would agree, British politics this spring.
No, I think the feeling amongst MPs is, phew, we got away with that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in the end, it leads to increasing disenchantment with the political class.
But George, obviously, say the House of Lords. You want to smash up the House of Lords and replace it. Then you have to...
Smash? That's your word.
No, if one wants to, then you need to fall back on the Parliament bill. That takes a year. They haven't got a year. Mm. You know, it's not fortunate, but that's not their fault. The one thing they could do is change the way the Commons works, because the Commons makes its own rules. Well, do you sense any sign they're going to do that?
Other people who know the ins and outs of Parliament better than me would be interesting on this. But I mean, as I understand it, there is a serious attempt to look at how Parliament operates, whether it's the way, you know, the power of the whips, the influence government has over the timetable, membership of committees, that kind of thing. At the moment, there's a lot of ideas being talked about. I suppose we have to wait for this committee to appear in, with its recommendations in the autumn, don't we? I mean, Tony Wright's a good guy, isn't he? I mean, is he going to come up with something interesting, Julian, do you think?
I think they will. And actually, the moment to look for change is just after the election, whether the Tories come in or whatever happens. The record is that shortly after elections, that's the moment Parliament gets changed, including by Margaret Thatcher, who did the best reform of Parliament in the last 30 years, which was to introduce select committees, which hadn't properly sat before 1979. The Labour Party, after 1997, introduced a less good reform, which was to formalise the timetabling of legislation, which really did kill off a lot of activity in the chamber. But I think there's some hope that the right committee will produce a few good ideas that will be followed. Mm. Depends a bit on the speaker, and I've got to say nobody's holding up much hope for him at the moment.
Well, that was another so-called reform that went a bit wrong in many people's eyes. I mean, but Cameron's interesting on things like second job for MPs and that sort of stuff, isn't he? But whether there's much interest in the really big seismic sort of issues, voting reform being one of the Guardian's favourites, of course.
Well, a new politics might be a daydream, but if you want to read about the daydream, you can visit Comment It's Free and click on the new politics logo. Well, this is our last Politics Weekly for a while, as Parliament shuts up shop for its luxuriously long summer break. So it's a time for reflection, perhaps on the turbulent events of the year, and who better to run us through them than Michael White.
White Noise with Michael White.
It's been a long, hard year for Gordon Brown. Groundhog year, in fact. He ends it where he started, in the doldrums. Two Julys ago, Tony Blair's successor was riding high. Then he fluffed his general election option just as the economy first faltered. The Tories moved ahead and stayed there. Fast forward to last July. Labour had just lost the Glasgow East by-election.
John F. Mason, Scottish National Party, SNP. 11,200.
David Cameron was 20 points ahead. In an article for The Guardian about Labour's faltering future, David Miliband failed to mention his Prime Minister by name once. Leadership plot, cried the media, which loves plots. It was Miliband's turn to falter now. The disappointed media turned upon the wimp. Then, in distant New York, the Bush administration allowed Lehman Brothers to collapse.
You know what? Right now, breaking news here, stocks all around the world are tanking because of the crisis on Wall Street.
Not a mistake Brown and Alistair Darling made with Northern Rock. In the fast-deepening crisis post-Lehman, Brown was suddenly the global man of the moment. His economic recovery package praised and mocked, but mostly praised and copied. Nobel economist Paul Krugman called him a saviour. President Obama got elected.
Change has come to America.
And got the limelight too. Brown was mired in the daily grind again. In April, he had a respite chairing the G20 summit in London with quiet competence. They even did some useful work staving off economic nationalism, which it was and is the real threat to recovery, not temporary bank nationalisation. But no, at Easter, Damien McBride, Brown's political muscle man, was caught peddling poisonous emails. emails and sacked.
I take full responsibility for what happens. That's why the person who was responsible went immediately.
Down Brown plunged again. Even the expenses scandal, not his fault, hurt Labour most. The Prime Minister fumbled his response on YouTube.
I'm announcing today urgent proposals to make our system of MPs' allowances in excess of expenses simpler and less generous.
As June came round, he faced another leadership drama. This time, Alan Johnson was the media's pick to save Labour. Brown wobbled but refused to budge. Johnson wouldn't move against his leader. Hazel Blear's Jeff Hoon, damaged goods both, quit the cabinet, so did James Purnell, who stabbed Brown in the front, as John Hutton, another resigner, declined to do. No point in wasting blood and shot without Johnson's declaration. He didn't declare, so July produced another lackluster reshuffle, another economic summit, another relaunch. Brown, still failing to give clear direction or leadership, staggers towards a May 6 general election. Dog days indeed.
Julian, anything been achieved?
Well, Gordon Brown would say that over the last year he saved the banks, and that in history that'll be his great thing.
And Paul Krugman would agree.
And Paul Krugman would agree. And there's some evidence to say it. I think the most fascinating period in politics was that little bit just before and then during and then just after the party conferences. The first British bailout sort of ended it. The news of the collapse of Lehman Brothers began it.
The Tories left their party conference to come to London for talks with Brown.
Yes, the Tories came down to London, but it wasn't clear what they wanted to do. At that point, Vince Cable was a hero too. And perhaps if we're going to talk about the year, we should just pick up on the others, because that was very much about Brown. Cameron's year, well, he'll be pretty happy with it. He got through well enough. And yet, I'm not sure he's much clearer at the end of it what he wants to do in government than he was at the beginning. So there's worries there, and he's suffered a bit in the expenses scandal, and his parliamentary party's fairly restless. Nick Clegg, probably on balance a mild improvement for him.
Tom was so convinced that you were going to say it was a disastrous year for Brown that he was ready with a rebuttal.
Yeah, I was, rapid rebuttal unit, Labour Party training.
Maybe me and you'll have to have this.
Well, no, I mean there are. All I was going to say is there are things besides the economy, which economy is the big thing, and I think we'll remember that. But there's also been, George, the 50p tax on the rich, which lots of Guardian readers have been demanding for a long time. There's pulling out of Iraq, and then there's some detailed policy stuff on schools. We've had more stuff on schools. And then even this week, we've seen a great clutch of stuff, abolition of compulsory retirement, social care, and all this green stuff. And yet what Brown hasn't done in any way is tied it into any kind of a story. And I think Labour Party members, even loyal members, would find it hard to describe what the government's for. What
I know, and that's such a sort of failing. You realise that actually individually, as you say, and it's interesting just to remind oneself of the good things as well as the bad, because, you know, being journalists, we always tend to exaggerate that, I think. But it's the overall narrative, his inability somehow to pull that together to say, this is what I stand for and this is why I should do it, which means that the bits that don't fit that quite positive narrative, the lack of braveness on sort of Trident or ID cards, or all the sorts of things that people are saying, come on, let's just have a few really bold, stop triangulating, just go for the big one, you know, which actually arguably 50p tax was. Somehow there isn't a sort of boldness about it. And maybe in the end, you know, a lot of people have sort of speculated on this. Is this what is the difference between a very good sort of deputy or chancellor or something and somebody who's actually a prime ministerial material? And it's that ability to be able to kind of convince that you know, the part, what's the expression, you know, that the parts are the whole, you know,
it adds up to
something. Yes, it adds up to something. That's what I'm trying to say, that, you know, it's more than just the sum of the parts.
But he certainly failed to do that, and I think a lot of the things that are coming out from government now are really departmental ideas which have sat around with Brown not making a decision. Suddenly Parliament's running out of time and they need to put them down chamber. So we're suddenly getting a sort of huge car crash of stuff piling out of the government in the last few days.
Well, it's partly because he thinks that we've been going around saying too often, look, what do you, you know, you're not doing anything, what's the agenda, you know, and suddenly he's in a big hurry, isn't he?
But the big debate of the last few months is, maybe back to the economy, has been on spending and the deficit, and he's had over the last few days really to allow his ministers to climb down on his position on that. So he won't end the year in anything like a happy mood. He's got less than a year to go to the general election, and goodness knows what it's going to be like in the autumn.
And, Julian, will he be there?
I'm not certain. I think it's quite possible that we've had the last parliamentary premises questions involving Gordon Brown as leader of the Labour Party. It's not certain, though, but I would put some money on that.
But what's the mechanism? Because, I mean, it
the mechanism.
Party conferences are always moments of unity. They are never moments of disunity.
Mostly, until they are the other way around. The mechanism is that the people at the top of the party just despair. There isn't going to be some formal process of letters, and it won't necessarily involve the backbenchers. They won't even be together. It may just be that the infamous men in grey suits or whatever clothes they wear these days just get rid of him.
But if you don't have the moment of the clarity of unhappiness from a cohort like the backbenchers, which you're right, probably have had their last opportunity, but if you don't have that pressure, why do the men in grey suits bother?
There's sort of lots of theories doing the rounds about what will happen in the autumn. One of them, which bits of the Conservative Party believe and are preparing for, is that Gordon Brown will call a general election on the grounds it's his only chance to surprise people. Another is that he hasn't got...
It certainly wouldn't surprise people.
It certainly would, and I wouldn't entirely rule that out. Another is
that... And when would that be?
That would have to be in October. Another, and he would use the autumn to do that, and he would try and challenge the Tories. I don't think that will happen, but don't rule it out. Another is that he'll just suddenly go. And there's a theory that Blairites like to say Gordon always backs down. In the end, he never fights the great challenge. And the general
Brownites
election
say
is...
that too.
Brownites now say that too, because it's true. And faced with that, if you take that theory, he'll back down and he'll suddenly say, I'm going. He might even say it during the party conference. Not certain, but don't rule any of these things out.
What do you think, Georgia? It strikes me.
Well, I think, so much turns on the economy. I mean, yesterday's just terrible news on unemployment. You know, this kind of awful sense of a generation leaving whatever stage they are in education with no jobs. This sort of contrast that I just have found so unbelievable this week of Goldman Sachs bonuses back, doing incredibly well suddenly again, and yet there's sort of devastation still in people's lives across the economy. And I think whether Gordon Brown will survive or not depends so much on that sort of, sense come the autumn, I think, of how the economy is doing. And is there any sense of, in other words, picking up a bit to kind of, negate a bit of the disaster that Labour people think the general election will be? But, I mean, I don't know any more than anybody else, really, whether it'll happen. I mean, Julian's better informed than I am on that. But, it's just they're also slightly running out of time. And also, the thing that I have always found difficult is, who's the convincing candidate that's going to get Labour's vote up better than Brown at the next election?
And however bad it is, doesn't he have, if you look back compared to a year ago, people were sort of saying, God, we've waited for 12 years for Gordon Brown, and what is the gentleman for? Mm. What on earth does he stand for? But all the credit crunch stuff and even unemployment underlines it, that all his economic expertise and interest in those things kind of does give him an edge over other candidates, doesn't it?
Very kind of you.
You're being still very kind, even though Julian wasn't as critical as you thought. Well, it sort of does, but, they are these awful hard choices that are coming down the slipway. I mean, I think that's just going to be very difficult for him as much as it is everyone else. I mean, maybe Julian's right and he's stopped kind of telling quite the same amount of sort of putting the same amount of gloss on these really hard spending decisions that are going to come. There's also Afghanistan. We haven't even talked about that, but, if that gets worse over the summer, that could be a turning point, I mean, who knows?
Okay, to bring it to a close, heroes, and it can't be Vince Cable, and it can't be Gordon Brown.
Oh, God.
George, come on.
Oh, come on, Julian, you go first. Heroes of politics.
I think Alistair Darling's had a good year. He's fought off an attempt to remove him, and he's also been very clear and cautious about spending and investment.
I think I'm probably going to be the only person in the country to say this, but I'm suddenly wondering about Bob Ainsworth.
No.
Because he's a guy who doesn't look like a special advisor. He's turned up in the cabinet given a kind of plausible...
No, he hasn't. He's been dreadful. His performance in the chamber the other day was an absolute disgrace, and they're in terrible trouble on helicopter.
Okay, if
we're going to stick to Labour heroes, then I think James Pennell, he was the brave one. He'd resigned. The others all wanted to. He did it. And he did it because he believed
I'm going to opt out at this stage. I can't think of one.
Heroes.
Vince is still my hero, and I won't have anyone not allow me in the frame. him in the frame.
Well, that's your lot for this week, and of course for the parliamentary session.
We are going to be back to party at party conferences in September.
And in the meantime, it's goodbye from her.
It's goodbye from him.